for my people in the front, in the nosebleed section. This is for the headsets, loving the mix. My people in the front, oh, covered in spit. Batters in the box, suffered a pitch.
Hello, and welcome to Grab Talk. I am your host. You know, I want to do it old school. Shaheen Elvendi! And the ever handsome, beautiful, long haired, got shorts on today.
Yeah, flip flops even.
Quentin Wilson, bro, no free feet. This is, what are we
doing? Oh, I should I have like blackout?
Yeah, see, I'm wearing socks. Nobody sees this shit for free. Pay up, fuckers. You want some free feet? Go somewhere else.
Oh,
this,
man.
This Rap Talk is not the place for free motorcycle feet. Oh my God, is it going to be our new OnlyFans page?
Free motorcycle feet?
Rap Talk feet. You know, I know a lot of motorcyclists and none of their feet are something I ever want to see.
No, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Just after 8 hours of a track day. No, thank you.
Yeah.
Go shower right now. Go elsewhere, you dirty son of a bitch. Q, couple of special things in...
Special?
Let's call it 15 minutes. It's Persian New Year, so happy Nowruz to you.
And what did you call it earlier?
Aid. Yeah, it's a lot of different names for it, but we call it Nowruz, which literally means new day.
Nowruz.
Yeah, it's the start of spring, and we, unlike the weird Westerners, we like to celebrate when the flowers come out, not when
it's the depths of the horrible,
freezing cold,
gross, and winter.
Well, yeah. Actually, it's January 1st, so it's going to be the first to fuck off. So anyways, happy Persian New Year. It's the year of the dragon and the Chinese year and the year of our Lord and Savior motorcycles in the Western year. I don't know.
Time to get warm. Yeah. Mezcal.
Yeah,
I'm on Mezcal. Cheers.
Here to chat with my buddy about motorbikes and motorbike life. So a couple of things I want to cover today. One is your shenanigans out in Daytona.
Mm-hmm.
A lot went on.
Yeah.
A lot of cool new things in Moto America, which is exciting.
Yep.
And we had promised our listeners that we're going to try to talk a little bit about the motorcycle industry life.
Okay.
So I feel like we should probably cover some of that today and
just
touch base on some things. Maybe we'll get some things right. Maybe somebody will call us and yell at us for saying something wrong or the wrong thing. But we're here for it. So you were in Daytona for Daytona Bike Week.
I was.
Tell me everything.
So I was there for the race, which is a bit different than being there for the bike week.
The race. But, oh, really?
Yeah.
Is there a disconnect?
Well, it always had been. And I would say the blend now with this bagger thing, it starts bringing it straight up. It has brought a lot of the people that normally wouldn't go anywhere near the racetrack.
Yeah, yeah.
They are all about cruising down whatever the strip is in Daytona. I don't even know.
That's Main Street, bro.
There's Main Street, but then what is A1A, Beach Run Avenue? Is that Miami?
That's Miami, but I mean, they have the beach front, but
isn't that much going on? Isn't that the same thing though? Isn't the highway that runs along not really?
A1A is like waterfront, and then there is like the causeway across from the causeway. There's another road usually.
Just cause.
But I mean, from what I remember, bike week would be from the west.
Had you been? Of course you would. You were
in Orlando.
You were in Orlando.
I worked at a Harley shop in Orlando. You tell me if I've been.
I guess I never thought that.
Actually, you would think, right? Here's the fucked up thing. If you work in the motorcycle industry and you live in Central Florida, that week is like the week to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, so you just,
especially in the Harley world,
you just stay there and make money.
We would sell in March. We would sell like 200 motorcycles. And most of it was in that 10-day period, and we couldn't really go to Daytona.
Would you sell Road Glides?
Road Glides, Street Glides, Road Kings.
What, dude? What is the bagger? What is the bagger that I work on? Do you know?
It's a Road Glide.
It is a Road Glide.
It's a Road Glide.
Okay, yeah. I wasn't sure.
I love that you didn't.
Can
that be a T-shirt? What is the bagger I work on?
Is it an Astro Glide?
Is it an Astro Glide? It seems smooth.
It's so slick.
It's so slippery in the wind.
I wasn't sure if it was there's so many glides, and I don't know them.
So there's a Road Glide and the Street Glide.
Ah, that's right. It's the fairing on the forks.
Right.
And the fairing, somebody did describe that to me, and it helped me kind of understand, even though they all look the same.
And Harley people would like to remind you that the Road Glide handles much better than the Street Glide because you don't have 60 pounds of fucking fairing sitting directly on the suspension.
Oh, yeah.
It's sitting on the fairing.
Yeah.
Now, the word handles better is, you know, loose translation.
Yeah, did I learn a lot about that,
though? I bet
you did.
I mean, how does your bike handle?
Really well.
Is it like an Astro Glide? Does it just glide through the night at the Daytona?
Yeah, apparently. I mean, the fact that a kid that is 19 years old that has raced mostly small board bikes, I'm sure he had raced a super bike. I guess I'll have to ask them.
Yeah.
Hey, when you raced Chuck Wall, did you ever race a 1,000cc bike or whatever?
Like, but what's the biggest, gnarliest bike you've ridden until this?
Yeah. And right now, all I know, though, is he had like a Twins Cup championship and the smaller bike champion, yada, yada, yada. So he gets on one and he got fifth in the first race. So that should tell you not only that is he good,
right?
But the fact that the bikes are remarkably well sorted at this stage.
Yeah.
Like, so 2020 baggers watching it on TV, it was pretty laughable.
They were
just because it was like you knew what they were doing if you knew, and you're like, that's ridiculous. And you could see it. You could see how bad they were.
Hats off to these absolute champions.
Sure.
Every single one of you.
But then every year, I think it's been, you know, if you look at it as a ramp up and then a plateau of development, that's the way all things are. You get the ramp, and then eventually it starts flattening out
right, where
you've got so much happening. And I think I wouldn't say we're close, but closer to the plateau than they were in 2020. That's for sure. Because the bikes, I mean, you can only polish it so much. It's still 620-pound thing. Right, steel frame,
yeah.
and the engine, you can't modify a bunch of stuff that surprised me, and I learned more about what can be modified, not the frame, not even
you can't
even freaking lop off a bracket, you can't add anything. Bizarre.
Wow.
Absolutely. And I thought for sure, oh, there's got to be some bracing or whatever. Not engine
race
cases
on Sunday, sell on Monday.
Yeah, well, it is more so.
Yeah.
If you wanted an engine that would only last like I don't know, maybe a few hours,
maybe on a good day. I do appreciate there's something really pure about the idea that they're using a like stock factory frame.
Yeah. It almost makes me respect it even more. I tell you what, the whole thing made me respect it more. I've been watching this for years enough, and I'm one of those people that just loves to be contrarian. So when it first started, I was contrarian enough to be like, okay, all right, this is a train wreck. I will watch this, no doubt. But I wasn't going to get that deep into it. But now I'm in it, and now I've seen it,
boy,
and now I
ever
understand it. I must say it's pretty cool stuff. So back to Daytona, that's all I see. We get there, and we had to go like display the bikes on the outside of Daytona. I think it was on Wednesday.
Okay.
That's setup day. And we couldn't roll in and set up early enough. So we were like, well, we'll just roll these bikes over to the Revzilla area.
Okay.
And then just hang out. So that gave me the opportunity to then cruise around the vendor area, which I had never done. Which is a mind boggler because you get to see why and how all these people that do this very specific type of thing do the thing they do.
Did you buy some chaps?
Well, that's the thing. That's exactly what it was. Like you could have like stamped, you could have played bingo with what I saw.
Oh yeah,
right?
I'm sure.
And that was an interesting thing for me to actually walk through the stickers and patches area. There was one.
It's colorful.
Gigantic. Yeah. Colorful is right.
PG version of saying it.
Yeah, I don't think there's a good way to say it. And I'm just going to be really straight up. I'm just going to kind of not talk about that level of stuff. But it was an interesting thing for me to see the various levels of, I mean, you could get a patch that's a walrus. I'll say that.
Yep.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Yep.
You are in a walrus. Mm-hmm. Boom, walrus on your, you could just iron that
I
on.
I love walruses. Walrus?
Walrus. And that's what I call it. I don't know. So that was an interesting thing for me to see. Then the bikes themselves. But walking through and then boom, there's the Triumph dirt bike that I would have not.
What?
And there was nobody, not a soul anywhere near the Triumph.
The wrong crowd.
Right? And there were two of them. Two of this is a new dirt bike. Like the new 250, the one they're racing and Supercross. And I was like, I can't believe I'm getting to see this, and there's not a soul around, right?
See Quentin standing around like, guys, is anybody else seeing this shit?
Yeah, right. And it was cool to be able to see it and just kind of look around at it.
Man, did you see a Boss Hoss? That's what I want to know.
There was a whole tent of them. Was I going to go anywhere near it? No.
What?
No.
You would never ride one?
I would ride one, but am I going to go look at one with a bunch of brothers? I'm not. And I'm not a brother.
This is next level brother.
Yeah,
this
is capital B brother. I am not. I am cousin. So listen, cousin. So I did get to see a Mandela. I got sat on a Mandela.
That's amazing. You did it. You did it. Our dear listener, Josh from Piaggio, is like, yo, bro, you want one?
And I'm like,
I got the hookup.
Oh, it's so close. We'll have to talk to Josh.
We got to see if we can get one for the Brap Talk, test platform.
That would be
maybe
really
that's
cool.
The next level of Brap Talk. We start testing motorcycles.
Unfortunately, it'd be guaranteed good press. There's no professionalism.
You have to be honest.
I would just be like, I'm gonna go rip this thing the fossil and back, and it's gonna be awesome. And you
hey,
know
can
it.
Have some new tires on this because I promise you they're gonna be worn out by the time.
All right.
Was this at? Why does it say A group? Don't worry about it.
This sticker. So anyway, that was good. Got to see that. Then the racing happened and. The racing was intense. It was Daytona is always a nightmare. It's really, really hard on equipment. It's a 3.5 mile track about.
That's huge.
Which is long. Most tracks, I would say, somewhere between 2 and 2.5 miles. That's right. The normal. You've got outliers like Daytona, Road America, which is like 4 miles long, and that's in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. And then Texas, that one's like 3.5 miles long or thereabouts. And they all, because of that, usually have long straightaways. Well, Daytona, it's not straightaways, it's banking. Ooh. And because of the banking, that just puts extra stresses on every single part, whether it be suspension or brakes or engine, more than normal, and causes bikes to break. So that is a fascinating thing to watch, but it's horrible to have to participate in if you're unprepared or if the team's not solid. And I will say we had a great weekend. The performances weren't there for the baggers that we would have wanted as Vance and Hines, but anytime you can walk away with points from Daytona,
yeah,
and you don't have crashed bikes or crashed humans,
right?
You've won. So I was super stoked because we had, let me see, we'd got like 4th, 5th, and 5th, 10th, and that was that, right?
Okay.
Not great, but not like, again, shit happens, right? Racing is difficult. So that was good for me. And then they had brought, they call it the mini bike, which is the GSX-8R.
Oh.
Which is...
The parallel twin?
Yes. So we affectionately call it the mini bike because compared, even though it's an 800cc...
It's literally half the weight of the thing.
Yeah. like or less. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, actually, I think it is. Yeah, no doubt. It's half the weight, half the size... Gixxerator, because it says GSX.
Gixxerator.
We were calling.
I love
it. All right, I thought that was pretty good. It's a Gixxerator. So
that
anyway,
amazing.
That went well, and that's a bit of a weird one because the Twins Cup class was up to this point. It was like 700cc twins, and there's all kinds of other rules and regulations and stipulations relative to that. And they were like, "Oh, we'll let the Suzuki with 800cc's in, but you're just not going to be able to modify it as much as, say, the Yamaha R7." Which on the R7, again, I don't know the rule structure exactly, but you can do like cams and pistons and headwork and yada, yada. You can do all kinds of stuff. Mm. Where on the Gixxerator, they were like, it was like pulling teeth to get them to allow a cam. So they did. And Vance and Hines was able to get one in time, even though they only had the bike a month. They had a campground because
that's amazing.
They're pretty high level.
Holy
and
shit.
So that was cool. But they worked with the main dude at Moto America that is the tech guy, and they worked with the other team running this bike, which is M4 Suzuki, which is basically the road racing world.
It's pretty big, right?
Pretty
big team.
So they all worked together and said, "Hey, we're going to be doing this thing. How can we best make this easy? And that way, the part is available to somebody else." So with that was it. Other than that, just chassis stuff. And the Rocco was able to get, I think, 4th or 5th in the first race, and then 2nd in the second race, which is bad for some stuff because we were like, well, I guess we're not going to be able to modify it much anymore, right?
Yeah, you got to figure out what the limit is on that.
That's
bike.
The deal. But going to Daytona and basing anything off of Daytona, it's difficult because you'd think, oh, well, you're good on power. Yeah, but top speed power and being able to haul the mail on the banking isn't necessarily going to exactly translate to doing well at real tracks, right? So we'll see how that goes, but it was still cool to see that this team was able to build these baggers. Yes, they won the championship last year. They're the championship winning bagger team. Mm-hmm. Of course, you'd expect the bikes to be good.
Yep.
But they built the bikes. There were some modifications done over the winter time, not heavy, but they worked. They made every session. We were able to go away and everything was really good. I can't get into great details with this because I've just got to wait until I see what I can talk about.
But what I like is that, you know, you guys were able to go there and kind of have like feet in the fire test.
Yeah.
Like
for sure.
On a very challenging track that takes a lot out of the machine and the rider. And I love that you guys came out without
pretty good,
like in pretty fucking good shape and with
that,
data.
And what I was going to say though, is relative to that is that the other bike, brand new bike, seriously, they got it like late January and then it's circulating at Daytona and it's getting on the podium.
Slide the nubbins on the tires.
It tells you a lot about the team, how good the team is in general. But of course, Terry Vance is going to have amazing people, but there's a few of the dudes that are in there. That are just incredible. A guy named Josh and Steve. Those two are the main ones that were responsible for making the thing good. And then a technician named Matt who helped me out greatly during the weekend. Because like we have to do an engine swap. Most of the other teams do at least one engine swap per weekend. So yeah, that was my first rodeo and I needed help.
Yeah. So what is the learning curve for someone on their first rodeo? It's funny because our friend Jared was even talking about becoming a fly-in tech again. And it makes me think, like, let's say you've got experience in Aprilia land or Ducati land.
Sure.
And then you land this bagger gig. How apart is the knowledge base from where you're coming
from? It isn't. And that's the thing. It's daunting because you're looking at, like, this huge, heavy thing. But in reality, the nuts and bolts of it, literally and figuratively, are fairly simple. So yes, to get the engine apart, to get the engine disconnected from the transmission, which is something I never thought I would have to say other than in my own fucking Ford F-150, to disconnect the two is actually complicated. There's special tools that have come out and you have to know a process and all the parts are big and heavy and gnarly. And yes, it's gnarly.
I bet.
But once you have a system, process, procedure, and the protocol to do it, and especially if there's two people, like in this case, they were like, this one guy, Josh, he is the technician for Hayden Gillum. He deals with that bike. He's been doing it for years. All these guys came from the flat track world. They're well-versed in taking bikes apart and putting them back together. They're experts at the highest level you could possibly be. If you gave them a Ducati MotoGP bike, they'd be just fine.
They'd figure it out.
And that's, you know what I'm saying? If I gave them, any one of these guys, the Yamaha R1 that I had to do the exact same shit to last year, they would be just fine. It would just be like, you just learn the idiosyncrasies and the problems and the issues and the tools that you need and yada, yada, yada. And you can do it. So for me, it's the same. It's just supersized. So that was that was the thing. That was the learning curve. And it's not heavy, but getting to have like this technician, Matt, he came over and he grabbed one side of the bike. I grabbed the other side of the bike and you know, you just take it apart and 6 hours later you have a new running motorcycle that has a new engine and a new transmission or whatever the thing was that we changed in that specific time. Right. And then the next day, Rocco went and hauled ass. And it was a really good feeling not only to be able to know, okay, I put the thing together right. Nothing fell off of it. But I could work with another technician, which is not easy. Right. So that for me,
you guys got to figure out each other's rhythms.
Yeah. And there's a dance you have to do. And
is there a lot of communication in that?
There can be. But like this dude was able to just put like this little stereo thing you have. Mm-hmm. He was like, what kind of music do you like? And I'm like, I'm pretty open. He's like, how about country? I'm like, yeah, let's go for
it. Yeah.
We're in Daytona. I'm working on a motherfucking Harley Davidson in Daytona.
In the country.
I am the most American person alive right now. Let's listen to country music to just add a layer.
Tattooed on you, son.
Right? I know. I need the Barnes shield. I need at least a bald eagle somewhere.
Something.
Right?
That'd be amazing. I hope this happens.
No.
For the memories of Daytona.
No, that's not. Yeah, only if we win. If I win, maybe I'd consider it. But
okay, you heard here on Brap Talk.
No, I have the Osprey, and I think that is the. Close that's enough. Not the only bird. I have a bat. I don't need. I want a Roadrunner. From a journey that I took that I really want. That's the only other bird that I think I'd put on me.
What if you get an eagle and actually make it bald headed?
That would be worth it. Like, totally, but bald.
Bald eagle.
Just like, I'm going to use your head.
Yeah, see? There you go. Full model for this shit. I am a bald eagle. I am a Shaheen that's bald.
That's a Shaheen. That's right. We were just having this conversation that a peregrine falcon is Shaheen.
That's right.
So, but that's a peregrine falcon. That's not a bald mother effing eagle, right?
That's a bald falcon.
Yeah.
It's a bald falcon. That's why it's the fastest bird in the sky. It's bald.
Falcon A, right?
Falcon A. You made me hurt my falcon ears.
So that was a good time, I must say. And now we are definitely chomping at the bit.
Yeah, for what?
For Texas, because we are the show.
Okay,
at COTA.
So when is that race in COTA in comparison to MotoGP weekend?
It's that weekend. We are racing.
I'm so excited for this.
But this is what's going to be bizarre. The more I was in it, the more I'm thinking about. I mean, we're not going to be in the garages with all the MotoGP teams.
Come on.
But we're going to be basically right there. Yeah. Apparently, we're parked right at the front, and we're going to have our trucks. Oh, man. It's going to be so good.
Texas is going to be banging.
It's going to be so interesting. I'm just so because excited. There's going to be gobsmacked level of MotoGP people.
Oh,
they
yeah.
have to be. There's nothing about these things when you see them in person that isn't just gobsmacking.
It's epic.
Right?
It's truly, it is colossal. And I mean that in the literal sense of that word.
Yeah, that's so good. And that I'm looking forward to. And I think we are as a team, because even though Austin has that long straightaways and high horsepower is needed,
mm-hmm.
you definitely still need a bike that handles. And it was very apparent that our bikes were very good on the infield at Daytona. They just were not quite, they could stay in the draft kind of, but not well enough.
Mm.
So, that's what I saw, and we didn't really talk much about it because I am just a mechanic, and as long as Rocco goes out and does the thing, which he did, and both riders ran off in turn one trying to keep up with the other pack, I think overriding the bikes a little bit because I had to. Yeah, it is what it is. They didn't crash. They did well. They finished their races, but I can't wait for the races. Like, I didn't think Rocco would be as fast as he was. I figured he'd be like a little bit further back, not just position, because there's not like a ton of, there's not like 30 riders in this class. This is an expensive proposition mm-hmm. here. But lap time wise, he was only a few seconds behind when at the end of the race. So we're not, and Daytona is an outlier. So I'm super excited, because I'm not saying I feel that he's going to win races, but man, I think he's going to be a factor.
He looked super solid.
And fucking comfortable.
Right.
Like right off the back, when you see him like hanging it out like he's on a supermoto bike. So there's videos he posts of himself riding at the Southern California Adams Car Track or whatever, hanging out a supermoto bike as you do as a young kid. This is what they all do. They show right. themselves sideways going into corners, sideways coming out of corners.
That's sexy, bro.
And watching like first session, sure enough, on video, they've got him doing the exact same thing with this freaking wildebeest.
Fucking A.
And it's like, wow, that's cool that he's that comfortable. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the fastest way around the track, but at least there's comfort to be able to say, okay, dude's comfortable. Now let's get him to, instead of being completely sideways everywhere, let's get some traction happening.
Yeah.
Right? It's easier to get somebody that's comfortable faster than somebody that's riding stiff-armed and like, oh my God, get me off this 620-pound wildebeest, right? And he's not. He's just like riding it like like he's at a kart track. It's really cool.
I can't imagine you can answer this with detail, and I don't want detail, but like, are there levels of adjustability and traction and ABS on these things?
No.
Or are they just kind of raw, go out there and figure it out?
No, there isn't. So that is the thing. The rule structure is pretty tight, so they're not going to be like a superbike in the electronic controls realm. But the chassis, yeah. But you're limited by this wheelbase that's like a Ford truck.
A small school bus.
And you're seriously, it does limit how much you can actually accomplish. But they have managed to figure out CG, and moving the CG a little bit and how it affects it. They don't use brakes very much. But
how are they moving the CG on these things if you
you're
have
not,
a stop?
Well, you're just like raising ride height.
Got it.
Just playing with ride heights
okay.
and playing with the adjustabilities that are there in the steering pivot and just basically ride heights and suspension
stuff.
But not a lot. That's what I'm saying. They've got to a point. They're limited by ground clearance. They would go even lower than they are now in some ways, sometimes in some tracks, but then they just scrape primary cover, right? Because it's so wide and big.
So wide.
So you kind of have to have them raised up. And anytime you raise up something like that, the swing arm angle goes extreme. Then you have a shit ton of mechanical grip, which then makes it like slide out and snatch very gnarly instead of smooth flow. It's hard to explain this, but like getting on the throttle and having it slide and just be like, get on the throttle, break the rear tire loose, and just let it kind of creep out and haze and slide.
Right.
If it's a flat swing arm angle, it'll do that more. Whereas if you have an extreme angle where it's, you know, I don't even know the degrees, the further it is angled, the more it just tends to have mechanical grip. But when it goes, it fucking snaps.
Let's go.
Right. Yeah.
Can they extend the arms?
No.
Wow.
Well, you could, but you don't want to.
Yeah. How much longer do you want to make this fucking
thing? That's the problem, right? The crazy thing for me is the brakes. I thought for sure the brakes would be like the biggest thing. No, they're like the least important thing on these bikes because they're so heavy and because the way they decelerate, you just...
There's going to be a ton of engine brake on these things.
That's the deal. And they just want to tear themselves apart because of it.
Yeah. It's amazing.
There's a thing on the end of a Harley crank called a compensator. It's called a compensator.
It's just a rider, bro.
It freaked me out. I'm like, wait. What did you call it? It's compensator. And I'm not going to talk.
First we learned about a Jiffy stand, now a goddamn compensator.
Now compensators. And I'm just like, do you understand what that means?
I feel like they did it on purpose.
You literally have something called a compensator.
This is the goddamn team that wouldn't name their adventure bike the Dirt Glide. I am so disappointed.
Oh, yeah, right? They need compensators. So that's a Harley. I mean, that's something that I believe. I mean, I haven't looked at the parts book to see the Jiffy stand and the compensator.
What's it compensating?
It's this weird compliant element hanging off the end of the crankshaft that keeps shock loads from going to the rest of the system.
Huh.
And it is huge and cumbersome and
compensates.
That's all I'll say about it.
That's what she said. It's huge and cumbersome. It's today I saw a guy on a like Nardo gray Road Glide with Olin suspension in the back of it.
You just said Nardo gray.
Yeah, it's
Nardo.
Nardo.
It's a test track in Italy. How is that even a...
So Audi has a gray or had a beautiful like... Before every fucking company started coming out with this like clay putty gray color.
Yeah, sure.
Audi had it. It was called Nardo gray. So that's the first thing.
That would have been like on an Audi TT from 2001 or
right,
two.
Right,
yes,
right, exactly.
I know exactly what you mean. Okay. That was Nardo gray. But Harley doesn't call it Nardo.
No, probably
okay.
not. It's probably called Freedom Gray or whatever. But you
it's
know.
Oil patch gray.
Ooh, I like it. Compensator gray.
Clutch material gray is what it would be.
He rolled past the shop. And of course, if you're going to ride past the Ducati shop, you got to make all kinds of rowdy noise and rev it up and do.
Sure.
The thing looked good.
Yeah.
Like it was gray with these bronze wheels and the Olin's, you know, shock reservoirs on each side.
Isn't that funny to see them? They're everywhere now. It is a style.
It is.
They have to have those. Oregon. They're like, how much are those? Olin's. And they're like, they're $5,000. Hell yeah, brother.
Yeah, brother.
Let's put them on. Don't hide those little nitrogen cannons.
Show them.
I want to see them hanging off the bike of them. Like they put them up like as far as they can. I'm like, of course they do.
Dude, it's like, of course they do. Instead of a rear sissy bar rack, it is now these Olin's
on either side of the shop.
Awesome.
It's crazy.
I love seeing that. It's like seeing a Cadillac Fleetwood.
Yeah.
With Olin's.
Oh, and Brembo's.
And I want that. I want that.
Absolutely. So that's the thing about all of this. The more I'm in it, the more I'm like, hell yeah, brother. This
well,
is because
you love
amazing.
Tinkering. I mean, come on. Look
absolutely.
At your van and look at your truck.
Yeah, absolutely. No. I want to build one. Like I know that sounds crazy. I don't want to own one necessarily.
Let's do it.
But I'd love to build one. And I don't think you would not build it like it is on the track. But I bet you can make it really, really close. And I would be like today. I saw Alonzo Bowden, the comedian.
Yeah,
he posted a picture of his BMW something or other that he was selling, which is actually one of the only cool BMWs that's ever existed.
Which one does he have?
It's a Megamoto.
Oh,
and he was selling it. And he's like, oh, I think I'm just gonna get a Harley or Indian. And I was so tempted to be like, dude, let me. You'd have to pay me. I'm not going to do this for free.
You would.
But I want to build, not a full-on race bike, but boy, using the rear sets, using the forks, using the triple clamp, doing the chassis right, carbon fiber bags, right? Do the thing that makes it the race bike, but not build the engine so that it would be like this, brightly lit candle lit at both ends.
I bet you anything Alonzo's going to be in Austin next month.
Yeah, that's right. You should. And do you know him?
Yep.
Okay.
And we can just pull him aside. He's the coolest dude ever.
He is. He did a thing with Ducati actually in Miami probably 10 to 15 years
ago. Orlando. I know the guy who built his bike, Nick Anglada. He built that 1098 into a Street Fighter.
Oh, I do remember that. No, what I'm talking about is he was part of Ducati, did a dealer meeting. And we all got on a boat. And he was the entertainment. He told jokes while we were going through the bay.
That's
in Miami.
That's a big man right there.
He is, and he's rad.
He's super
so
rad.
So he wouldn't know who I am, but I had met him multiple times, and he's a cool dude, right? So I saw that, and I'm like, man. I was just trying to think, who the hell do I know that would want something as stupid as this, right?
Listen, here's my proposal. Let's go super stupid. Instead of this V100... that you like.
Yeah, right.
Didn't they make of something 21? It's like a GX21 or MX21 Moto Guzzi full street glide looking thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Make one of those a bagger? Yeah, right. No.
Go full racer bagger on that thing?
No. That's the beauty of these is that you do the chain drive conversion and it actually is a real motorcycle, whereas that Guzzi is still shaft drive and that's
Just lost half of our listeners.
One of the only things I don't like about the Mandello, but it is what it is. But for racing, it's kind of like, sorry, that doesn't not that moment when you accelerate and the whole bike lifts up instead of down. Fuck that. Right.
It is a hell of a feeling if you have never experienced a shaft drive.
The worst one in the world is a Suzuki Intruder 1400.
Just any Suzuki shaft drive. It's like directly connected.
Whatever it is, that thing will, you just whisper the throttle 4 inches upwards immediately. It's the craziest feeling. It is awful. It is nothing that I would ever, ever wish on anybody. Mm-mm. It's antithetical to how a motorcycle should work. No.
Yeah, but then you don't have to maintain it ever again, apparently.
Yeah, whatever, sure. Whatever.
Still gears in there, bro. You got to maintain it.
Yeah, you do. And when you do maintain it, it'll cost the same amount as the 5 chains and sprockets that you would have had to buy in between, right? So anyway, good times. Good Harley times for sure. Fascinating. What a weird thing. If you'd just shown a picture of me working on something like this to me, even 5 years ago, I would have been like, fuck right off.
I wish I had a time machine so I could go back to Skippy Q
and just smack me on the head. Yeah, right. Oh man.
Hey, one day you're gonna work on race Harley. Just hear me out.
I would have, you know what? You would have seen at Pro Italia, you would have seen on one of the cabinets above my workbench, I had taped, and I still have this picture, an XR750 Harley flat track bike.
That was a cool bike.
Extremely cool bike. One of the only cool Harleys that has existed to me. And I had that up there with some 500 GP bike and the Britain and very much so. The writer, Gonzo Journalism. Why am I? Hunter S. Thompson. Hunter S. Thompson in the book Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail 72, there's a picture of a Vincent Black Shadow that has been reworked into a cafe racer. And I had that. So these are the bikes that I had taped up on my, just for cool bikes.
Yeah.
So if you'd have said you're going to be working on race Harleys, I would have been like, oh, cool. I get to go flat track.
Neat.
Racing,
finally,
right?
A flat track bike.
You'd port me to where I am. And I'd be like, fuck you, man.
What the fuck is this shit? You fucking with me? That'd be amazing. it's funny, when they came out in the mid-2000s with the XR 1200.
Yeah.
I remember being super excited about the concept of that.
Yeah.
We talked about the bike shed already in the last episode, but when we were there, one of the retail salespeople, this tiny human being, they can't be more than 120 pounds. And they ride an XR 1200 and they make the bike look massive.
Yeah, sure.
But they go out and shred on this thing.
I got to ride one of those, a race prepped one, at PIR. about 10 years ago, there was the team that was latest Ducati that turned into latest Triumph. They also on the side were racing those because latest, of course, was a Harley dealership.
Latest loves racing.
Joe Kopp, who was I believe a national champion,
right?
National number three for the longest time. So Joe's from Spokane. Him and a kid named Chase McFarland, who ended up being a really good technician slash crew chief in this paddock. So Chase was at the time riding one, and so was Joe. And I got to ride Chase's around PIR. And then, you know, they had outfitted to race. So I meant it had the 17-inch wheels. And I mean, there's some changes to those things that made them okay. But it was still a bike with like a hinge in the middle because it was a rubber-mounted thing, right? I don't think they could change, or they tried to change, but it didn't work. The rubber mounting of the engine to the frame to make it stiffer, yada, 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 which I found out that that doesn't work. And that these bikes, like, dude, that the race bikes
try to twist itself.
They are, the frame is the only thing. The engine is completely rubber mounted, and the rubber mounts are as large as the ones that I'm putting in my van to put a Cummins in my van. Like, they're huge.
How long are these good for?
I don't know, but we, if the engine comes out, we change them. So
fascinating.
Yeah. They're definitely, you don't risk it because that's
you're already doing the thing. You might as well change them.
You're in there and they're not easy. Like, it takes a lot to
like
change
changing
them.
The oil and not changing the
exactly. Yeah, you know, so,
filter
so
you or whatever. It. Just do
and,
the thing.
But when these things start, it shakes up and down like an inch, right? It is insane. I can't believe I'm working on this shit.
I can't believe it. To ride one. Yep. I'm terrified of them, but I want to
ride one. No, I'm not terrified at all. After watching these guys, I want to ride one. Because you know me. I love taking my big bike onto the track. I enjoy that. This is like right up my alley. Like more up my alley than I would have ever thought. And the more I'm around, I'm like, I really want to ride one of these things. So I hope. I don't think that'll ever happen with this team, but boy, it would be cool if it did.
Oh my God, so cool. Something neat happened 2 days ago.
Oh, yeah?
A customer rolled his Husqvarna 701 SMC or Super Mono into the shop and goes, hey, you want to ride that to compare it to
that bike? And that's right, sure.
Wait, you listen to our podcast? He goes, wait, you have a podcast? I'm like, okay, that was an interesting coincidence.
Huh.
He just was like,
you should do this, yeah.
So I was like, hell yeah, give me the key. And so I took it out and spun it around for about a half an hour.
Did he do the same, obviously?
His son test rode the Mono.
Oh.
Super interested in it. And so we sat there and compared notes a little bit. What an awesome firsthand experience of the past and the current slash future.
Yeah, sure.
One thing that really came to mind was I have a feeling as of now, since this Hyper Mono is out and how it is changing everything about the Super Motard, you know, larger displacement Super Motard style of motorcycle, KTM, if they're going to stick around with it and if they're going to keep selling them, they're probably going to have to rework a lot of things.
Yeah, they're
going
to have to pivot to what this is. Because Ducati has obviously probably gone way more on the street instead of the dirt side, which is understandable.
Totally.
Whereas KTM was like, we can just throw some 17s and polish it a little bit, but it's still more of a dirt bike.
It is.
I bet it would be way easier to take that bike and put a 21-inch front wheel and an 18-inch rear and go dirt bike riding than the Ducati.
The suspension is still, you know, less travel than, say, a dirt bike, but the engine and how it sort of acts, the two of them are telling the same story from two such very different perspectives. The Husky, you know, the 690 motor is very like low end. It's all about that bottom end.
Yeah, sure.
It doesn't like you just revving the fuck out of it. Whereas the Ducati is just like, rev me, daddy.
Yeah.
It wants you to do that. It's more, you know, it likes it. And then above and beyond that, you can just tell this was a dirt bike on the KTM side that they sort of slapped these street like things to it. So it has like a separate button for ABS modulation and has a separate button for traction control. Whereas Ducati said, hey, let's just put everything on the computer. You just press a couple of buttons.
And do like we do with all of our other bikes. Yeah.
So if you're a Ducati rider, when you sit on this bike, the buttons feel very
super intuitive. Yeah.
Super intuitive. You know what's up. Even though it's just a kind of an old school slide style LCD screen, it's got a lot of information and it's really, really bright and super easy to go through. And the motorcycle, holy shit, the vibration difference, worlds apart. You can cruise on the Ducati all day long at highway cruising speeds or 55 miles an hour in fourth gear or fifth gear, and the bike is happy. It doesn't, your hands don't go numb. On the KTM, or sorry, the Husky, same, 60 miles an hour, fifth gear.
Feels like it's about to tear itself apart.
Dude, my hands just start. Yeah, I was like, man, this actually hurts. Now, once you get into, because I went up, and if you're around Portland, you'll know this. I went up Germantown with
it. Yeah, sure.
And it's close to our shop, and it's super twisty, so I can
and
just
And when you're accelerating
it
and decelerating through the rev range, it's amazing. A different story.
Totally different story. Sure, sure. So it's an interesting tool to take to a super tight, fun, twisty place and just use it for that singular objective. But everything in between sucks. Whereas the Ducati's like, no, just hop on it, do the thing. You can tell it's a new vehicle that's super refined and it's brand new and it has all the things on it. So immediately I'm like, man, if KTM, because I know having spoken to our friend who works at KTM, you know, he's like, this is not the biggest seller. They don't care that much about this particular segment.
Sure.
But if Ducati comes out with it and it becomes popular and now everybody's talking about this, are they now forcing KTM's hand into reworking the bike and coming out with something interesting? So it was neat. I was really grateful to get the experience and riding the, you know, the bikes back to back. I would, you know, any one of you that ride one of these Husky KTM products, I would invite you to try the Ducati just to kind of see what I'm talking about. It's fascinating. It's really, really neat to watch this progression of motorcycling. Basically, it made me want that Ducati more. It made me want to have that style of motorcycle more, because around town it's so much more comfortable. Today I rode home on my,
I was about to say, you're going to trade the Street Fighter in?
Probably not. They're such different machines.
I know.
You know, commuting on a Street Fighter V4 is just bananas.
Yeah, it is. It's overkill. it's a high level.
It's,
sure.
It's constantly
commuting on an Africa Twin is overkill.
Right.
But I get it. Sometimes you get, right, you got to do the thing. If you could, if you had the big garage and you had all the tools, you'd be like, hell yeah, give me a, well, like my XR650 for a while. I was like, I had to stop riding it because it was dangerous, because I would do stupid shit on it. And that's what it felt like being on that bike.
Yeah.
When I, even the small amount of time, I was like, get to the St. John's Bridge. I'm like, oh, I can just hop up on this curb.
Uh-huh.
And like, I didn't hop up the curb and hit the edge of the curb.
Yeah, but the bike's fine.
But I knew that I was going to be able to jump off the like 12-inch curb that's on St. John's Bridge with not even an issue.
Not even an issue.
Like, I was like, yeah, this bike is great.
Yep.
And then just zip right off. And like, oh, you don't even have to think about it, right? So anyway, that's the type of cool inner city riding that most people would be able to appreciate. Then you throw it on the back of your truck or drive it down the freaking Mack track and go do a track day at a small track, and you're not having to do 170 miles an hour, right? It's less of a barrier to entry to go either get your knee down or not get your knee down, but just go have fun in a closed course.
Yeah.
I think I'm hopeful that that type of thing will grow.
I think it's a brilliant idea, because it doesn't feel like a gatekeeping kind of motorcycle. It's more allowable for a much wider,
especially for
group of people.
Is it 12 or 13?
What's that?
$1,000?
13.
13. So especially for that in this day and age,
I know most
people are like, 13,000, like it's not 1995 anymore, man. I'm sorry, but everything is expensive. This is what happens, right? This is the way this goes. So you're going to have to deal with it relative to other machines. I don't know what the KTM's the same, right?
Yeah.
About
so. Exact same price. They're identical.
Okay.
So it's, I just feel like it does have the naughty side. It does make you want to do stupid shit with it. And maybe that feeling goes away after a while. Probably not. But I just love its quote-unquote simplicity. Now, Ducati's bananas, because they have like slide control to the point where you can back it in by just stomping on the rear brake.
Yeah, sure.
And then we just learned the race exhaust when you buy it. Not only does it have an up map and, you know, the horsepower goes from 77
explain
to like 80
an up map. Not everybody knows the term up map.
It's essentially
a map.
It's a new back in the day, you'd have to get some kind of a piggyback ECU to slap on your motorcycle so that it ran better.
Ducati's term for a performance map that's usually CARB legal or EPA legal.
EPA, I believe.
Ish.
Enough. CARB is and super.
I know that, but it's something like that where you might have to be careful if you're in California, but generally it's made to be, any rational, logical person would see the emissions coming out of the tailpipe on something and say, yes, this is fine, right? But unfortunately, CARB is not.
So
like
this
that.
Comes with a map. In fact, I feel like every brand at this point, if you buy their performance product, should come with the thing, right? So it has that, but on this motorcycle, it unlocks the wheelie control. not like wheelie stopping you from wheeling control, but like,
oh, like you can just whack this bitch open. You just yoink it and go. Yoink it. You can yoink and then yeet.
And just maintain. It yoinks and yeets for you. It's a cheat code really? For the yoink yeeting wheelies. Funny. The dank. This is the Dankonia of motorcycles now. So it's funny because they're like, yeah, when you buy the exhaust, it comes with that and also unlocks that. So go learn how to wheelie, young Jedi.
It doesn't like give it to you for a month and then you have to pay for it later.
No, we're not BMW cars or KTM. Or what's the other one? Volvo probably does shit like that.
I know it's the KTM thing where they give you, when you get the bike, like say the 790 or 890 Adventure, somebody told me, oh yeah, well it comes with all this stuff and I'll buy it anyway, but they gives it to you for a month. I'm like, oh really? They give it
wait,
to
they
you
give
from,
you a taste?
Yeah.
Fuck, I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Jesus yeah. wept.
Right.
Wow.
And for me, I'm just like, that is, stop it.
I feel like somebody in marketing was like, well, I've noticed the kids, they're used to now paying yeah. for subscription.
Absolutely.
You know, groceries sure. and food and, you know, sex and games. You know, let's just go on motorcycles too.
Yep.
Maybe that's the problem with BMW cars. Maybe the turn signals only come in a subscription. People
well,
like, fuck it.
Well, that was the joke though. There was some, whatever component that BMW is saying, like say your heated seats,
right?
They're not going to work. It's like, wow. I will absolutely never buy that product
no.
just because they have said
right.
that. Right. You know what I mean? Like I'm looking at my age and I think, okay, 20 years, could I go without buying a vehicle that is, with unless I'm like, there's a gun to my head because some government entity that said no vehicles after
you
certain,
must have heated seats you pay what, for
or whatever, right? For me, I was just saying this to Jamie the other night. I don't think I'm gonna own a vehicle that is newer than 2010 unless it's a Mazda Miata.
Fuck, I want one so bad.
I don't think I'm gonna. I just don't. I would. It would be very interesting to see what I would buy that is new because. There's me swapping my engine in my old Ford. And I've got, it's not leaking.
Swapping your engine.
My truck
Ford?
Is not leaking.
Really?
It's not leaking coolant.
Nice.
I fixed the alternator.
Nice.
It's charging.
Okay.
I made it all the way down to the Sylvania PCC campus to pick up a machined part that I needed to get today. And I got back and it's still not leaking. I'm like,
dude,
I'm in a really good way.
Celebrate. I know. I love it. I love it. I love that both your four-wheel vehicles are just these hodgepodge of
yeah.
weird cool shit that you're putting together.
Yeah, well,
Franken car over
yeah,
here.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Okay, so what's next?
Let's talk about the industry.
Okay,
you and I have very different perspectives of the industry because we've worked in. I mean, we've the Venn diagram has a center, but you got to do the factory side of things, and I've been just on the retail side of things, and the questions come up several times of, hey, you know, I want to come work at a motorcycle dealership or I would love to work for XYZ
brand.
In the industry, yeah. period. And it's funny, even today I had a conversation about that with a friend and I always find myself wanting to tell them like a beware truth.
Stay away. Stay away.
No, it's not even that. It's not even stay away. It's a hey, eyes wide open when you
no,
want
this
to do
is the way
this, right?
I frame it, yeah.
Because what we get a lot, especially in the dealership side, and I bet a lot of people listening that work in the dealership side get this. You always have some Joe Schmo who's like, one day I'm going to retire. When I do, I'm going to come work at a motorcycle shop. And it's like, yep. I think you think this is a hobby because the industry in the U.S. is a hobby
yep.
thing, right? And so, we, at least at Moto Corsa, do a pretty good job of curating these experiences and these outputs that we put out and say, hey, this is who we are. We have a blast. We do this. And we do. It is super fun. It is very engaging, but it is also extremely draining.
It's labor intensive.
Extremely. We work as hard, if not more than, let's say, the car industry. I have these meetings quarterly with the GMs and, you know, bigwigs at the car side. And I kind of look at what they do and I'm like, fuck, I do everything you do and then some. But
for way less money.
For way less money. And because it is a passion project. And I mean, I've said this before, you know, in previous podcasts. One of the downfalls of the motorcycle industry has historically been that it is underpaid because
people come in and work cheap.
People come in and work cheap because we've always told people, hey, this is a really yep. passionate thing. It's a lot like the food industry where people are like, oh yeah, I want to be a chef. I want to just do this because I love it. I want to feed you. I want to show you my art through cooking. And motorcycling is the same thing. It's like, I love motorcycling. I love the art of motorcycle riding. I love the freedom of going out there on my motorcycle and exploring the country and the world, and I want to share that with everybody. And so that is where the, I don't know how to call it, like this fantasy of it is, right? like we can really make it really sweet and charming.
That's a I call it a disconnect. There's a disconnect from totally. People that think they want to be in the industry but don't really know, because they who wouldn't know? You're like, oh, well, that's a way to make money. And I don't really know if there's an analog for this, because if you look at cars, is not the same.
It's not.
Not even like a little bit. And you'd think it would be very similar, but it's not. Bicycles, maybe a little bit. The margins are low. Right. It's tougher to make money. People are passionate about being in a bicycle, so maybe that's part of the deal. I guess what you got to figure out what expectations are. So the for when I was starting, so the mid-1990s, and we would have to look at an inflation scale to understand where it was at.
Yeah, right.
But motorcycle shops were $50 an hour, not $150, wow. Right?
More now.
And more. And a technician, so I'm going to go on the service side, a technician, if they were like a super heater, badass, well-known, well-established, proficient, then that they can work on the bikes and efficient, and that they do have a lot of throughput. Mm-hmm. So they're not Johnny Smoke Break, and they're actually every hour they're on it, they are actually flagging hours.
Yeah, like their efficiency
and
is high.
Right, and efficiency and proficiency, both right. of them are high. They could charge half flat rate. Like if the shop's flat rate, they would be half of it. That would right. be the highest level technician. That would mean they would make some money, some serious money.
Correct.
And I haven't seen that in decades, because I think as the expenses have gone up, it's just such a weird miasma of where the money and who's got training and who's coming in and working cheap, who went to Motorcycle Mechanics Institute mm-hmm. like me and expects more, whatever the things were. You know, it's been tough. I came out of MMI making $7 an hour, which was
at the time
was still yeah. Whatever the what is it minimum wage,
right,
or close to it. Maybe it was a little higher than minimum wage in California, in Southern California. I was making $7. Stupid. Then you know, I lobbied to get $10 an hour. Got $10 an hour, right? So that's crazy talk now. I'm thinking about that level, and I don't know, but that's what a lot of people would think of money first, but that isn't all of it. So that's
no.
When I strangely, our good buddy Kat, Brian Catterson, mm-hmm. one time he came to Pro Italia, and this was when I was making, my guess is I was probably making about 45 grand a year as a technician, a young technician that wasn't that good. Wasn't bad, but wasn't that good. And I was talking with him because I was interested in becoming a journalist. I was mm-hmm. like, that was one of my goals. I wanted to work on a race team. I wanted to become a journalist, or I wanted to design motorcycles, right? So those were the things that I was kind of working right. on. And I was very close to Art Center College of Design. I had taken night courses at Art Center in Pasadena. Wow. And I had done a bunch of courses at Pasadena City College. Realized that probably wasn't my jam, just seeing the way that was going. Started making a shit ton of money working as a mechanic.
Right.
And then started racing myself. So that was the path I was on. But one time Catterson came in and we, you know, he's picking up, you name whatever bike that right. he was riding for probably Cycle World at the time. And we started chatting about what it was like. He's like, you know what? If you are looking at the motorcycle industry, if you are looking at working in it, and how much of that part of your life is the motorcycling, and you want to be in the industry,
right.
you have to look at the things that you're getting by being in it as part of what you're paid at. So I am not paid very well to write for these magazines,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't had to buy a motorcycle in however many empteen years.
Right.
And I haven't had to buy gear in however many blankety blank years. And I haven't, and on and on and on.
Like it's paying for
changing sprockets. And so the thing that he loved doing at the time, this was 25 years ago, and it would be interesting to talk with him about this now.
Yeah, for sure.
He was like, it's worth it to me now. Will it be forever? Maybe not. But right now it works out because this is my life. This is what I like to do. He's a 10-10th enthusiast. He's probably one of the higher level enthusiasts that you can get.
Right.
And has ridden everything from freaking 500 Grand Prix bikes to MotoGP bikes to all the dirt bikes. And I mean, he's a consummate enthusiast. And there he was telling me as a young Skippy, full Skippy at Pro Italia, that, hey, that if you want to keep in this or be in this realm, it's not going to pay well. You probably will make more if you're already working as a mechanic at this level now. You're probably going to make more doing that. So just consider that. And right. and you're also in the industry, so you're getting a lot of the byproducts of bikes to ride and deals on bikes and deals on gear and freebies and all the other stuff. So that's part of the deal. And that was actually a healthy way to look at it. And that, though, is a part of the problem, because the people like that would come in, not like him or me, but people that would look at it like, oh, I'm just going to come in and grift my way into motorcycling. Right. And we have watched this over the past 10, 15 years of influencers doing that, coming in, working cheap, devaluing the rest of the people.
Correct.
And making it very, very difficult for anybody to make money.
Right.
Because you're already like just cutthroat for margins, whether it be selling a jacket for and getting $5 in your pocket or selling a motorcycle, and everybody's like, oh, dealership, you're making all the money off your sales. It's like, no, you're not. No, you're really not. No. Or coming in and having to finance somebody for fucking 96 months and at 12%, that type of shit. Like, where is the money made? How is it functioning? And that's why I got the F out of dealership as much as I can. And I try and tell people to be weary. You sometimes have to pay your dues being at work in a dealership, and you should, because you're going to learn way more than you think.
Right.
Especially if you're going to end up at a OEM. So I highly recommend that you at least have had some dealership parts, sales, service, whatever it something is. That way, you know, from the ground up, because that is the first point of anybody's contact in the motorcycle industry is largely the local dealership. Mm-hmm. It's not, but is it? I don't know. This is where the question I wanted. Like, if I'm looking on Instagram and I'm a car guy or a car girl, and I'm like, I like Porsches, and then you see a motorcycle, and you're like, eh. But then eventually, I'll start looking at motorcycle content, and then your feed changes, and it's, I'm just saying Instagram, because right now that's still kind of the most viable, right? That's the most viable, understandable.
I mean, even on TikTok, it still reads your habits and kind of goes that direction.
Sure. So either one of those, I can almost say that's interchangeable. So if somebody's not into motorcycling, they can get into it. And I have watched a few people that follow me that are in my circles, but not necessarily motorcycle people. Mm-hmm. And they'll ask questions and they're curious, and that might be their introduction to motorcycling. And then YouTube, right? That's a lot different than me skipping on down to the local Honda shop and learning as much as I could from them, then buying Sport Rider magazine and learning from that, and then buying Superbike magazine from England and learning from that, and then adding on to that knowledge that I could only get through paper, right? That and then going down to the local shop and going to the racetrack, which I was fortunate to live in an area where I could go out to Texas World Speedway, and I learned a lot from doing that. But not everybody has that privilege.
Right? They don't. And I mean, it's you brought up a couple of really good points. One is that the method of consumption for all this stuff has changed majorly, right? 20 years ago, you had X number of print magazines that you could pick up and, you know, get your information and your wisdom about motorcycles from. And then forums started, and then Facebook, and then all this other social media. And the other thing that you said is influencers, right? You have all these people who are just, well, who did pretty well for a while, and they got a lot of followers to watch them talk about stuff. I've seen influencers grab motorcycles for various different manufacturers and say things like, this is the best bike, this is the greatest experience, because they're thirsty for that experience. And that works for some people that are consuming this information. They want to see the experiential part of it from Joe Schmo influencer's perspective of saying, oh, this dude got to go to Big Bear and ride motorcycles with Alpine Stars and, you know, get to talk about
it. They must be cool.
Right.
They must be really good at what they do. They must be amazing. I'm going to follow them. And then they follow them and they don't know that or they haven't seen it. I've said this recently to every beginner, an amateur could be an expert. Okay. So a beginner is looking at that amateur, full fledged, horrible, doesn't know shit, fucking D-bag amateur. That's good with a camera, that learned how to take video, that's really good at influencing, that because they have learned that, but is an awful motorcyclist and bad at what they do on every possible level. Yep. And they're the ones that are espousing the most, and they're the loudest voice. So that, unfortunately, watching that over the past 10, 15 years has been so disheartening for me, because I'm just watching the various people like, oh, did you see? And I'm not even going to name any because I don't give a shit. But you name the influencer. Oh, well, they did this. I'm like, yeah, no, that's
yeah,
not.
No, no,
that's
no, not
that's
how it
not
is.
Cool at all. So how do you do that? How do you sort the wheat from the chaff when you've got these fancy person? Well, they're doing a wheelie. They must be. Oh, they have their knee down on the street. They must be good at what
right,
they do.
Right.
Whatever the thing is. And you know what I mean? Like,
that's the thing. Social media has made it. If you have a certain specific thing that you like or fetish or fantasize about, it'll just keep pushing that to you.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't matter if that person is good. Like you said, it could be an amateur, but you can cling on to that ideology that they have with them. And it isn't the full answer, but this is something we can talk about in any realm, whether it's politics, cars, motorcycles,
absolutely, that's
food,
true,
whatever,
yeah,
right?
That's very true. Yeah.
So let's go back to the idea of the industry side of things. You know, it used to be where young Shaheen or Quentin could walk into a Pro Italia and go, "I love this," and have a Chili White or a Bill Nation go, "Here, this is what it's like. Maybe someday you two can do this." I was having a conversation with Bill Nation, who owns Pro Italia, after our last recording. And I was like, you know, I was thinking about having walked into your shop as a teenager and having had kind interactions, which then sort of reinforced my belief that this is a cool group that I want to be with because they were accepting, they were kind. But like you said, to a beginner, an amateur looks good. So for just some nobody kid, having a sales team whose job is to be selling, talking to me in a nice way. They weren't trying to sell me anything. I was a teenager. I was
just by virtue, it's just part. It's intrinsic.
It's
part intrinsic.
Of their thing.
They are selling motorcycles.
Right.
They were selling, and Pro Italia is better. It's much like Motocorsa was selling more than just motorcycles. You're selling the lifestyle. That's cheesy. I hate it. I hate saying that, but it's true. Yeah. It's absolutely true. There's no way around it. You have to admit. We live a lifestyle. Motorcycles ends up being a lifestyle.
Totally.
Some people's motorcycle lifestyle is different than others. So am I trash talking the influencer people? Is their lifestyle any better or worse than mine? No, but are they misguiding a bunch of people and setting false expectations?
Right. It's an edited, cropped vision.
Yeah, it's not the reality.
It's not the reality. There are certain ones out there, like my buddy, I don't know if you know him, but my buddy Benjamin Sell, he has, what is it? It's A Dork in the Road. He has a great YouTube channel, but he's very realistic. He's more about moto camping and mid-level, like mid-size adventure
biking. He calls himself a dork, apparently.
A dork in the road, right? And he's such a cool dude. He's all about, he always ends his like videos with be excellent to each other. You know, I like stuff like his because it's educational. He talks about what camping gear to get, what to expect, what to do. And he kind of...
No, there's a bunch of these people. They're amazing. Blind Thistle,
right.
Amanda.
Love Amanda.
These are certain people. It's like, I wish we had... Whatever, what I had was magazines that were vetted. The people that were inside these magazines were all vetted.
You didn't just get
you couldn't
to walk
just
in.
Become them.
No.
You couldn't. No. So anybody that was writing generally... in the 90s was good at what they did. There were racers that were writing about sport bikes.
Right.
There were dirt bike racers that were writing about dirt bikes.
They're
extremely good writers that understood grammar and syntax, and they were writing properly.
Right.
That this was a whole nother world, and it doesn't exist. It's very rare now.
Now you have to sift through a lot of bullshit.
It does. And so I want to help be a sieve for this. And I've said this for a while. It's like, how could we, you could have like this list of, these are approved people. If you're listening to a podcast, because here we are influencing, like, I guess we are the D-bags that we're talking about, but I guess as
T-Man would say, oh God, just what the world needs, another pair of white dudes behind microphones.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, she's the one pushing us to do this because here's the thing. Not trying to toot my own horn, but because I love this lifestyle so much like you, it's a funny double-edged sword for me. I don't like gatekeeping, but I also don't want bullshit.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so as a retailer, I have the privilege and the honor to be a gateway to just about everybody. What I don't want is for someone, and I'm saying this for a reason. If you intend on getting into this industry, especially from the dealer side, because frankly, that is the main path.
That's the easiest path to get into it.
So
yes.
If you want to be that person who goes into it, may I suggest not being a gatekeeper? What does that mean? It means don't make it just about a specific thought or a brainwave or a pattern that you think is right. You have to look at the whole and go, how can I get as many people involved in this as possible, right? If you just say, I'm only baggers or I'm only sport bikes or I'm only wheelies or I'm only dirt bikes, that is gatekeeping. That is you saying, I only want to pander to this specific group and ignore the rest of it. Not necessarily my success, but my belief and what I'm going after is, how do I open this up to as many people as possible, right? The only ones that are not really actively welcome are sexist, racist, misogynistic fucks. Period.
Yeah, sure.
Fuck off. You're not. You're not
otherwise,
allowed, right?
If you're riding whatever, as much as I might not want to be on that KLR, you are in the wind.
You are,
and
my
you are
hero.
Stoked. Well, that fuck was the yeah. video that you put. Was it you that brought that one? Where this some British guy was like, "Let's evaluate the motorcycles and what this
him.
Says about you."
I love them so much.
And then there's the motorcycle. Looks like you're having a lot of fun on that bike, whatever it was.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is. Matter. It could have been a Honda Monkey. It could have been a KLR 650. It could have been a Honda. It whatever. He was just like, looks like you're having a lot of fun on it. And part of me is like, fuck that. No. No. Gatekeep it.
Yeah.
Right? But I saw very clearly what he was trying to do. Very funny, very good. And he's right.
He's right.
You know what I mean?
And that's that in the dealership side, that's the mentality that is needed so that a girl, a person of color, a what you would call an alternative lifestyle person, I made quotation fingers, which is not good for podcasting. When they walk in into your shop, they don't need to feel unwelcome. All you're doing is saying, hey, check out what I do. Check out how much I love doing this. And yes, you can do it.
You
as
can
well.
Do it too.
You
yeah,
can
absolutely.
Totally do it
yeah.
too. You can do it. You can ride a dirt bike. You can ride an adventure bike. You can ride a race bike. You too can do this. There are pathways to it, and I would love to show you how that is. Whether you've, you know, quote unquote made it and are looking at a Ducati in my shop or going into the local big box four major Japanese brand stores and looking at your first Rebel 300, fuck yeah, dude. You're doing the thing. Great job. It's our job to open the door and the pathway and show people in a transparent and realistic way of how to go about doing this. One of the questions I ask a lot of riders when they ask me, hey, what's your favorite bike? Well, a lot of them.
Yeah, right.
What are you trying to do? Well, I want to buy
plus one.
Yeah, I want to buy a Multistrada because I want to be able to go do this, this, and this. And I've seen your videos and pictures and I talk about them. And then I say these words that makes their eyes kind of get big. Hey, you should be honest with yourself and ask yourself a question. What am I trying to achieve with this motorcycle?
This is a whole different conversation. We should do this because I have kind of a formula for this as well.
Ooh, I'm
excited. So we should get into that at some. That is how to choose a motorcycle.
Yeah, we should do this. This is the next.
That's another
next,
one.
Next podcast is how to choose a motorcycle.
Your point though was to how people are coming into the dealerships and introducing themselves to the.
Right.
And we're talking about how to get into the industry. Let's get back on that track.
So the reason I'm saying all this stuff is what I would look for, what I would love to see more in the industry is. Yes, still passionate people that want to do this thing, but know that you're going to work hard. You're going to be holding a lot of hands. You're going to be answering phone calls and emails and texts all day, every day while you do this thing. And because it is a quote unquote passion project, you're going to be doing it a lot. And especially if you live in an area like we do where it's seasonal, between let's say March till September, you're going to be working a lot of weekends that you want to yourself. As I said in the last podcast, we are the bartenders of the industry.
Yeah,
right?
That's true.
When people are partying, you're pouring drinks. When people are out riding with their group buddies and in their favorite road on a Saturday, you're working at the dealership. Or on a Sunday, you're at a track day helping people realize their dreams. So what is it like to work in the motorcycle industry? Buyer beware. It is fun, but it is very, very demanding of your time, your patience, your energy, and it does not pay a whole lot because we live in a world of tiny little margins. Now, some dealerships like mine make it where we pay people a little bit more, but we have less people doing more, right?
Yeah, that means you're going to wear more hats. You're
right.
Probably going to get paid accordingly, but you're going to be doing more stuff than you would if you were Joe Schmo or Betsy Schmo at a shop in the middle of the country somewhere. But then this is dues paying.
Right.
So this gatekeeping idea, though, is you can't just all of a sudden go generally work for a manufacturer as a regional representative without having paid some dues.
Right.
maybe there's a chance that you would have gotten an engineering degree or some other type of a degree that some middle management mishmash a-hole would look at him like, okay, I'm going to hire this person that has no dealership experience.
Yeah, they're looking for a new perspective.
I think this will be good.
Right.
And I've watched that and it's horrible. So right. Doesn't mean it's not going to happen. The industry from the bottom all the way to the top at the toppest toppity top levels,
toppity top top level,
has the same issue where people come in cheap. So I have seen people that are in C-suite positions that are not C-suite Google, C-suite Tesla, C-suite, right?
These are not million-dollar-a-year salaries.
I've seen people that are, though, right? I worked for Michael Locke, and he was a badass, and it was fun and engaging, and he suffered no fools. He made very few friends, but, man, did he sell a lot of Ducatis.
Yeah, he had a vision. He knew
and it was really cool to see that and to work for somebody like that, but then afterwards getting to see other things and you're like, oh, this is awful. But you know what I mean? Like that's that. Unfortunately, I keep watching it over and over and over in the industry. You're thinking, ooh, this person will be good. They have been in the industry for X amount of years. They have seen this many things. They must be progressive. And then you get in and it is antithetical to everything that you thought was going to happen because of that. And it's very, so be ready for that. So that kind of stepping stones, if you're going to get in the industry, generally you start at the dealership, yes. Yep. If you can manage to wiggle in at a manufacturer or a parts distribution
thing, Parts Unlimited or Western,
you might find yourself, especially if you already have a sales background. Mm-hmm. Say you sell houses. What is that called?
A realtor.
A very real realtor. And you're very frustrated by the law that just got passed that says no more 6% on the yada, yada, yada.
Sorry.
Whatever that thing happened. And you're like, oh, man, I want to go sell motorcycles because this sucks. I'm not going to be able to gouge people to no end any longer. Right. So you get in and you know what? You might be okay at it, but you're not going to necessarily know those systems and processes and procedures and protocols to deal with the parts department and service department and the holistic look at how a dealership should make money.
Yeah, and all the intrinsic way of doing things.
You're going to only focus on selling motorcycles, and right. You're not going to think, how am I going to make sure that of all of my bikes that I sell in a month, that we get a bunch of them into the finance, am I going to manage to try and get that person who really desperately wants a bike and say, hey, if you want to spend X amount more thousands of dollars for this over the course of the time you own this, we can get you financed. But as long as you're doing it honestly, I don't feel there's nothing wrong with that. And then the little skippy me would be like, I mean, I just did it with that Africa Twin. I probably spent thousands more than I should have because I was like, whatever, however many months, whatever. Right. I wanted the bike. I was willing to pay the money. That was the value for me. I understand that. That type of thing. You need to have that. And then when it comes to, well, can we roll the exhaust system in on that? Yeah. Can we roll that leather suit so that I can go to track day? Hell yeah.
Hell yeah,
and,
brother.
Right? That type of stuff. You got to be able to know that and work within it and understand it and be able to pick people and say, okay, I think you deserve to get on this bike, or hey, you should really get on this bike, or whatever the thing is. Mm-hmm. On the parts side, you need to be able to know the various levels of dealing with the various tomfoolery that you have to deal with to get parts from all over the world, whether it's Japanese or British or Italian. You're dealing with motorcycles that you're getting parts from all, or even on the US side, the Harley side, right? Dealing with the motor company, dealing with the BS, dealing with all the various things that say, okay, you can't have the bar and shield here, and you can't do stickers there, and you can't put Harley Davidson, yada, yada, yada.
Corporate identity is a thing.
And it's a huge deal. So you get past that, then you get into the working for one of these companies. And in that realm, you got marketing, you got sales, you got service, and you have parts. And you have that. Then on top of that, the most of it is sales driven. So the higher ups, the CEOs, the C-suites, the all the controlling is to sell units. And you've got to understand that's unfortunately what kind of moves everything forward on the manufacturer side. Yeah, they might talk a talk and say, well, we're service. We want to provide good service for people, and we're going to sell parts. We want to make sure, because that's part of the service. We want to, after sales, we want to take care of people. And they do, kind of, but only when it's absolutely necessary and only when the sales aren't good. Right? And I've watched this ebb and flow over these decades where sales are down. Let's concentrate on service and parts. And then they go back up to service. And then sales are good. Oh, shit. Well, like, who cares about them, right? And then it's like, oh, we need to stuff more dealerships in every possible corner.
Oh, God.
Well, but what if those people aren't very good at what they do? Oh, who cares?
Who cares? They'll
right? Just... We just need to sell units, right? And then you have a diluted, shitty dealer network. And that could be Honda. That could be Ducati.
Any one of them.
But mainly it's the Euros. I will say this. Because Honda had been like
certain orange company that's growing really quickly.
Yeah, right. So we see that, and it's that is a problem. So you almost have to be able to read the waves. And like right now, if you said, "All right, hey, so and so wants me to go work for BMW," I would have to then do a look at, all right, where are they at? Because I don't even know. I wouldn't say no if somebody said, "Hey, I want to go work for Ducati." You know, part of me is like, "Fucking run." The other part of me is like, "Well, how much money can you make?"
Yeah.
I absolutely no reason to gatekeep it. I have said this to many people. I'm like, yeah, there's these people that I don't like and don't trust. But you know what? If you can extract a bunch of cash,
right,
you absolutely should go in there, and it says it on your resume and it's fucking amazing. So you should do that. Right. So that is what I would also look at as part of the values. Like, do you know you're going into a snake pit? Yes. If you do know you're going into a snake pit, you can navigate that. Right. I watched Indiana Jones get out of that snake pit.
Yeah, he did.
Right? Like, it was pretty
snakes.
Impressive, it right?
Had to be snakes.
Sometimes you've got to just, right? That is the type of thing, though, you have to look at. You have to have some fortitude, and you have to have, going back to your original point, empathy. You have to have the empathy to know, okay, little Skippy's coming in, and they don't know what they don't know,
right.
And I need to be the person that's going to guide them through this, not gouge them, find the way to get them into the industry. Yeah. Safely,
right?
Because this
we're
going
for longevity.
This also goes back to the influencers. What happens, and this happens to influencers, or this happens to everybody in motorcycles. They come in, they think motorcycles are cool. They see the racers doing the racer stuff. They see the adventure people doing the adventure stuff. They don't realize the most of the people that are doing really doing the thing, 80-20 rule, 20% of the people are doing 80% of the shit. They have 10,000 hours, whatever that. There's that cheesy thing where it's like 10,000 hours. But I'm not sure if
perfection
that's true.
Comes in 10,000 hours or whatever.
Whatever that BS is, I get it. But that is similar, something along those lines. That those of us who have done the thing have done it because we have so many thousands of hours on motorcycles, and that could be working on them, that could be riding them, whatever thing is. And I get, unfortunately, so many frustrated people. They'd be like, hey, let's go ride dirt bikes. Yes, let's go. And they go out and ride dirt bikes, and they look at, especially me, because I'm kind of an unassuming, long hair.
Right.
That kid, dude,
and
can't
you're doing
haul
shit
ass.
That I can only dream of doing.
But you see what I'm saying? Like, I am not even that good. Like, I know where I'm in the level of rider, and I'm like, not good. But they're like, fuck, he can't go. How am I supposed to ever get to that point? That is a frustration that a lot of people are going to have. They go out to the first track day and fuck the egos. Everybody thinks that they're going to be able to do the thing, and then they can't. And that goes for the industry as well. You get in the shop,
absolutely.
You think you're going to be like jet set right up to the top and make all the, no, man, I know that happens in some worlds. Maybe if you're a software developer nowadays, like, you could pretty much get out of school. If you're good at what you do, you can get out of school, make $250,000 a year just doing software-y things. I know that. I get that. That's an existing thing. There's a lot of that type of thing that's out there.
Our industry's still so old school about that.
This is not. And it's not gatekeeping. It's not us saying, no, you can't do that. I'm just saying,
just how the things are.
Dude or dudette, you get into this thing, it's dangerous. It's as much as we try and like not talk about how dangerous it is, it's fucking dangerous. And especially when you're younger and new, the newer you are and the younger you are, it is exponential. So every mile you get is almost more, it's like a times two, times four, times 10 at the exponent that you'll get further and further along. And unfortunately, that beginning time, that first year, that first 2 years, that first 5 years is so difficult to get through without getting hurt. And then, or having an engine blow up, or the thing that causes you to be like, screw motorcycles, I'm going back to whatever the thing was. I've watched it over and over and over again with people come in. Of course, normal, it's the puff chest out, the like a living, breathing Dunning-Kruger effect person that they get out and they go pretty quick right off the bat, and they think they're awesome.
I'm natural at this.
The beginners are looking at them as the amateurs, and then I'm in the A group looking down. I'm like, that person's all over the track.
Oof,
and they did.
Shit.
They got their knee down, and they're doing an okay lap time, but they certainly wouldn't, they would get their ass handed to them if they actually had to race, but they're at a track day and they're doing the thing. Or we go out to the woods and somebody like go makes it up the gnarly hill and they are feeling pretty good. And then on the way down, it's ass over tea kettle, right? There's no easy way in, man. There's no easy way. And that I feel with motorcycles is one of the more frustrating thing, especially in this day and age of you buy your Apple phone and it works and it's exactly what you need.
Right.
It barely takes any setup and all of a sudden you have your supercomputer in your pocket, your digital thing in your pocket and you're going, right? The motorcycles are not like that.
No.
They're never going to be like that. They're just not. If they are, then they're boring as fuck.
Then that's right? Where the passion goes away. I think that's part of the passion of motorcycling is that it requires you to be all there, right?
All the time.
Right. Probably it's not the reason, but one of the reasons we wave at each other, especially in the US when you see a fellow motorcyclist, because A, it's a hobby. B, you're like, yeah, I see you, bro. You're putting it out there just like I am on your fucking scooter, your 300cc scooter.
Do you wave at scooters?
Fuck yeah, I do, man.
I have done. There's so many in Portland that I feel like a dickhead if I don't, right?
I feel like it's more dangerous for them than it is for me.
It is. It is. They're more hardcore than me.
Fuck yeah. My Street Fighter, all I got to do is turn the throttle an eighth of the way and warp speed.
Yeah, right? These little pedal cutters, not to go too far off, but I live in St. John's, and there's a very well-known scooter / what are the little ones with the pedals? Mopeds. The moped contingent, Sabatino Motors.
Oh, hell yeah.
So they're all the crawling around in that area. I think I might have told the give the gas story to one of those dudes. Anyway, so I see them all the time, and there's a lot of scooters around, and you just get used to waving at them. Because you know what? You're in the wind, man. That's part of the deal, right? And the same, I do it to Harleys, even though it is 50% I get a wave back. 50%.
I wave very fanatically at Harleys.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck yeah. The whole arm and hand swinging at them.
I do love doing the over, and for those of you who are not actually seeing, we're waving kind of like Dumb and Dumber level.
Yeah,
like
you're excited.
Just fully excited, full body wave, right? Yeah.
So, much like riding a motorcycle, getting in the industry takes effort, takes time, takes a lot of blood and sweat, and is not for everyone. And the people who are in it for the passion of it and the people who are in it to try to make a difference are often the ones that are most frustrated because they want to do good. They want to see it grow in a good way. And they're swimming against the current.
And they're constantly, another wall comes down, crash, and then another wall comes down. But we're breaking through, man.
There's probably a lot of parallels to other industries in this. We haven't even talked about the apparel side of things.
No, I know.
Which is the most difficult part of the motorcycle industry.
Yeah.
I commend you, Mr. Pete Day, who created Moscow Moto and somehow created, I think, probably one of the most successful apparel / widowato of the motorcycle industry. But even watching that team work, it's very small margins. You're constantly having to pivot. You're constantly having to change the way things are. Just to try to make a difference, to try to make yourself bigger and more recognizable throughout the world.
Or cooler. And in the case of Moscow, they do an extremely good job making themselves cool. And they hire people and they take them. They were just on some journey in Baja.
It's a mandatory team meeting.
So this is amazing. And seeing all the people that I know that are in it and they're out riding around on Baja on awesome bikes.
Camping
and,
out. Yeah,
that type of thing goes back to Brian Catterson's point. If you have people that know what they're doing and know this is how you keep people involved, this is how you keep the stoke alive.
Right.
And a lot of those employees have been there for a very long time.
Right.
That is how you're going to do good in the motorcycle industry. And it's so rare. And it's basically, it was like the absolute opposite of what I experienced at SW Motec, where it was just like, right? Whereas that is the way.
There's a stoke there.
That is, and it's similar to Motocorsa relative to many other deals, say Beaverton Bob's or whatever. You know what? It's a motorcycle shop. You'll find fun if you're a good person, wants to be in motorcycles. You can go work at Beaverton Bob's and Honda. And I'm sure there's good there.
Or you could be the good there.
Or you could be one. You could be the one, the bringer of the good.
Yeah.
Or you could make it easy on yourself and you go to a shop that has the fucking pulse, right? Yeah. So same goes for that.
Those shops are harder to get into because those people don't look to leave often, right?
Nope.
The Moscow Motos, nope. of the world don't often hire people.
Nope.
When they had an opening, even though I'm in a place, a position yeah, where you I'm have to look at it, right? I was like, man, that's so tempting.
I want to go live in white
this
salmon.
Is so cool yeah. to live out in the fucking in mountains the and ride dirt yeah. bikes oh. all the time.
Yeah, for sure.
So that's the thing, right? I think, yes, I want more very cool people in this industry. I want to see the thing that made me passionate about it continue to happen. And because it's a passion project, more of those people will come. I just hope that they're treated well and they know their standards and maybe know how to, like you said, work their way through the snake pit to get the fucking final prize, right?
Yeah.
Whether that is to become an RBM or a general manager or the service manager for a shop, that's on you, whatever is your specialty. There's plenty of opportunities out there. There's lots of dealerships out there, but there's only a handful of OEMs. And if you try to become something at Kawasaki, Suzuki, Ducati, Yamaha, BMW, remember there's only a handful of OEMs and they're not as big as you think they are in the US.
I think
Ducati North America
small.
Has like
they had to keep themselves below 50 people.
Yeah, 50 employees?
For the longest time in the state of California, it was like some sort of tax thing. And I got there in 2009 and I left in 2015 and there was only ever about 50 people.
Right.
And when I was gone, I was employee number 7.
Wow.
So that means I was the 7th oldest employee
wow.
in 6.5 or something
That's
years.
That's amazing.
So that gives you an idea of how bad, and that is normal. I would say it's maybe normal for Ducati more than any other, but that's normal for all of these manufacturers. Yeah. And it goes to that ebb and flow. People come in, sales are good, they're doing great, everybody's stoked, sales go down, they get blamed, they get canned,
that's right.
they leave,
that's
they get right. frustrated, whatever the thing is, and it goes on and on and on ad infinitum. And you get people come in customer service. Customer service is a meat grinder. And that could be customer service at a dealership. That is service writing. That is sales. That is the person at the counter. You are part of customer service. A lot of people don't think that they are customer service professionals, but
yep.
you are.
Yep.
I hate it with a wild passion. I'm sorry. Those of you who might have talked to me on the phone when I was at SW Motec, I'm sorry. I hated it. I didn't want anything to do with it.
Right.
I'm really good at it in email. That's right. You know what I mean? Like that is my way. That type of thing that you have to identify that in yourself. If I'm going to get in this industry,
be honest with yourself.
You're going to have to interact with a lot of people
yeah.
and you're not necessarily going to like a lot of the people.
No.
There are a lot of crazy people that ride motorcycles. I think on the continuum of motorcycling, it is a weird, different than cars.
It does not have a very, very tight Venn diagram. There's everybody.
It is all over the place.
It's all over the place.
And I would say there's a strange bend towards like, I don't know what the bend is, but for a lot of us, it is loners and I want to be independent.
Yeah.
And but conversely, in the past 10, 15 years, we're seeing a lot of, I want to be part of a club. I need to be with a bunch of people.
Yeah.
I want to be around.
I want to meet new friends. Oh. I want to go do things.
And that is you. You yeah. love it. Dude, you
totally.
Were literally talking about going and happened to buy a meeting of local, what was it called? The Triumphy people, whatever they called? Rocket people?
Oh, today the Rockets.
Rocket.
Yeah.
I think Triumph Rocket. That's why.
That's funny. I get it.
All right. Okay. That's what my head went. So you just went and had a beer with a bunch of people
yeah,
because quick. You enjoy it. Me, that's like,
you'd
man,
have seen them be like,
nope. I'd have to build up so much to be like, do I want to talk to any of
you,
this, right?
I feel like my social tank is much bigger than yours.
It is. Even though you and I both have said that we're more introverted than extroverted, but you are way more extroverted.
I'm way more extroverted.
Yeah.
I'm a textbook extrovert. My energy comes from outside.
But does it? Because you've also said that sometimes you get, right?
Sometimes I got to charge up
where you're
sometimes.
Like, and that to me had been the best.
I
definition.
Say I'm extroverted till like September and then I'm introverted for like a week. I just need a minute to myself.
And the various people have to be able to handle their,
yeah.
Their social batteries.
Yes.
And once I realized that that's what was happening. And when I was this was only within the past probably 10 years. And I remembered, I was thinking about Christian, our good friend Christian, who is a salesperson. He's a sales professional. He's one of
oh,
the
yeah.
best that will have ever done it.
God, he's
he
so smooth.
Absolutely takes energy from human interaction
yep.
and he thrives on it.
Yep.
And when I watched that happen and I realized that my battery was going down while his was rising and I was able to equate that, I'm like, oh, that's what it is. Then I can manage it better.
Yes.
Right. So once I know, and so that goes to, this is just life things, not motorcycle industry things. But when you're at a motorcycle shop, you are now in the social world.
You are.
And you can't not.
No.
If you are the person that's in the back as a crusty old parts person, you're not going to thrive. No. You're going to hate life.
Yeah.
Because you're not making a bunch of money as well. So find another industry, mm-hmm. make your money elsewhere, buy a motorcycle and ride the shit out of
Become that software engineer.
Right.
No, honestly, I mean that it's so funny. I'm thinking about my employees and how many of them are true introverts, and they come in, they clock in, they put on a smile. They really do a great job.
Yeah, sure.
And then I watch their social battery drain and then they go home. And it's so funny because they're the ones I'm like, hey, how was your weekend? What'd you do? And they're like, they have a smile on their face, like nothing.
Yeah.
I just stayed at home and I chilled the fuck out.
It was great.
And just, it was awesome. But what they are, and I think this is a really good example of our industry as a whole, they're a bunch of nerds who love motorcycles, right? Whether it's apparel, parts, sales, service, they are really passionate about that thing they do. And they realized in order to do the thing that they're passionate about every day, they got to put a smile on their face and they got to answer some questions once in a while and listen to stories and engage. And to an introvert, sometimes that's the hardest.
And not just be the taking it all
right.
or talking it all.
Right.
Which is difficult.
Yeah, you got to learn to pivot.
If you're stoked, I'm stoked.
Right.
I want to tell you all about all the shit. And you have to remember to have that empathy and just be a decent human being and say, you know what, I want to hear your story as well.
Correct.
Because then that will help me to be able to figure out how to help you more.
Right.
Or just to be cool with people on motorcycles because it's fun like that.
Just be cool with people, man. You know?
Be excellent to people.
Be excellent to people, as the dork in the road says. Be excellent to each other. All right. So in conclusion,
this could keep on going for a long time.
I really do want to, on our next podcast, we should talk about how to choose your first motorcycle.
First and or
yeah.
in between, like
just thought, your motorcycle
thought processes on how to identify. Because right now we are in the world of probably the best choice.
Oh my God, so many motorcycles options
compared to any other time I've ever seen. Like other than maybe late 80s, early 90s, there was a lot of really cool choices, but there had been kind of a dearth of it until recently with past 10 years, man.
Yeah.
There are a lot of cool motorcycles out there, and we should just have that chat.
I'm in love with that idea. We're going to do that on the next one. As usual, please follow us on Instagram at BrapTalk, B-R-A-P Talk. Wow, it took me a second. It just went away from
it's
my head.
It's not two P's.
It's not just one P. B-R-A-P.
It's not two A's.
No, not Brap. It's just Brap. Simple.
We're a couple of A's. That's right.
We're definitely a couple of A's. Send us emails. Tell us your stories. I want to see where you've been riding since the season's upon us and it is officially Persian New Year. So I'm imagining the grass is green where you're at. The flowers are blooming. The snow is melting away, hopefully. It's not too hot if you're in the southern part of the country and you're riding a bit. So send me some pictures. Where are you at? What was your favorite spot you rode this last weekend? And where do you look forward to riding again? Are you coming to Austin for MotoGP/MotoAmerica. If you are, Q and I will bring some stickers. He's going to be busy working, but I'll be walking around with poor Ann. Please freak my wife out. Just walk up to her and go, hashtag Team Ann, I love you. It freaks her out a little bit. I love it so much. That, you know, she is a great time. I'm glad to be going to Austin with her. I've loved watching her interaction with the industry and her rekindled love for riding again. So, super looking forward to that. I don't have much else. Q, what do you got for us?
Snoochie Boochies.
Snoochie Boochies. Okay, I love you. Bye. Make good choices. Safety third. Bye.